Retina Rounds, podcast number 29. Today we're joined by Dr. Alex Yuan, assistant professor of ophthalmology at the Cleveland Clinic Lerner College of Medicine and vitreoretinal fellowship program director at the Cole Eye Institute. In this episode, Dr. Yuan shares his insights on building a successful career in academic medicine, essential strategies for securing grant funding, and his philosophy on medical education. In addition, we discuss the keys to balancing the pursuit of professional excellence with a rewarding personal life. Let's check it out. Well, welcome everybody to the Retina Rounds podcast. Today we're really honored to welcome a very special guest, Dr. Alex Yuan, who is an assistant professor of ophthalmology at the Lerner College of Medicine at the Cleveland Clinic. He is also the head retina specialist at Metro Health, a county hospital associated with Cleveland Clinic, and is now the newly appointed vitreoretinal surgical fellowship program director at the Cole Eye Institute at Cleveland Clinic. So Alex, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you so much, Pradeep. I'm very excited to be on your show and looking forward to the interview.
Well, tell us a little bit about your path into ophthalmology. Many of our viewers are interested in going into retina. Some are interested in going into academic medicine. So I'd like to learn a little bit more about your path and how you got to where you are today.
Sure. So I think my interest in retina dates all the way back to my beginning research days. As you know, I trained as an MD PhD. My original graduate thesis was on ion channels and in particular potassium channels and the retina's very active part of our nervous system. It was a very natural place for me to go in terms of research. I was also at the time doing clinical rotations, and I remember very distinctly, I wish I remember the fellow's name, but I was at Washington University School of Medicine, medical student there, and I had a unique opportunity to scrub in with one of the fellows who, and I was sitting right at the assistant scope, and I thought I was in a completely different planet. I mean, the initial, clinical experience, I watched a vitrectomy and just was awed by it. And I thought, wow, perhaps I can merge my research interests with this clinical field. And that day began my, passion for retina.
That's wonderful. And so did you continue that work in residency? I should mention to our viewers that Alex and I were co-residents together, separated by 1 year. So we go back a long way. And I know that you were still involved in research, but tell us a little bit about how you were able to participate in a very rigorous clinical training program, but still maintain your interest and involvement in basic science research.
Sure. So I, as a resident at Jules Stein, they had a very unique program. It's called the iSTAR program. Still exists today. I think it's a wonderful program. It enables residents an opportunity to conduct laboratory-based research at the same time as their residency training. Really fantastic way to keep up your research training. So at the time, I already had my PhD. But wanted to expand my research interest into the field of retina. In particular, I had an interest in regenerative therapies. So I joined Dr. Deborah Faubert's lab. She also had an interest, and that began my current path and interest in studying, using a zebrafish model retinal regeneration.
Wonderful. And then what led you to Cleveland Clinic?
So from there, I was interested in, looking for retina fellowships that would allow me to continue on this path. I wanted to make sure I had very strong clinical surgical training, but also had the opportunity to continue on with research, in particular basic science research, and it seemed like Cleveland Clinic was the perfect place to be. I think throughout my path, I was very lucky. I had wonderful mentors who I can really look up to and kind of look to them for guidance and kind of model their paths. I think this is a great way to for our younger folks interested in retina it worked really well for me to kind of watch how other people did it. In particular, John Sears, who's still here at the Cleveland Clinic. He holds a very active basic science laboratory, and he's a very talented clinician. So I remember interviewing with him and kind of seeing what he did, and that led me to train at the Cleveland Clinic.
No, and that's great. We often look to people who are our mentors, people who have trained us, and we see where they're at, and we're motivated to try to emulate their career path. And now you're in that position where you have medical students, residents, fellows, maybe even colleagues who are looking at where you're at professionally, and they aspire to the same position. We talk a lot about different, fellows choosing different career paths, and typically we're talking about, well, is it going to be private practice? Is it going to be academic? There's a variety of different models, but I want to dive deeper into the various career paths that one can take within academic medicine, because there's not just one formula for being an academician. So tell us a little bit about kind of how your role in academia has evolved and where you see it going in the future.
Sure. As I mentioned, I've always kind of been interested and dedicated to basic science research. But I think since then, at UCLA actually, I learned that education is actually a wonderful area, and it's of it's also one of my prime interests currently as program director. But I actually have you to thank for that. I know I've mentioned this to you in the past, but you're a wonderful educator, and I just think we all owe it to our teachers. We don't give enough thanks to our teachers, really. I mean, I can't thank my prior mentors enough. I would not be the person I am today without them. You really inspired me to be a good teacher myself, you and my other mentors. At UCLA, we work very closely with our junior residents, both in the clinic and in OR, and we have great opportunities to teach them one-on-one, and that's really where I picked up my teaching style. I would say my current teaching style here at Cleveland Clinic Coli is very similar to my teaching style that I've learned at UCLA, which is one-on-one mentoring, but also allowing my fellows to some degree of autonomy, but at the same time, providing the safety of guidance.
Yeah, that balance is really key. And that's actually one of the most challenging parts as an educator with trainees, because you have two responsibilities. You have a responsibility, first and foremost, to the patient to make sure that they have an outstanding outcome. But at the same time, you want to train the next generation so that they can then go on to wherever they're going to be, deliver high quality care, maybe themselves train the next generation of vitreoretinal surgeons. Being an educator is challenging right now, and AI is something that is at the front of everybody's thoughts right now. It's completely transforming nearly every sector of economic and really just generally our lives. And we have talked a little bit. We had Ted Lang on recently talking about how AI might impact clinical care, but I'm interested to hear your thoughts on how you are, or any policies that you have that you've discussed internally, and how you balance AI with the goal of making sure that your trainees are
actively learning and absorbing all of that information. AI is sort of, it'll take you from point A to point B, but oftentimes it's the journey from getting to point A to point B that really has the value. And if you're skipping that journey, you might miss out on some really valuable learning experiences. So I'm just curious what your thoughts are on how we should be integrating AI-based learning into our graduate medical education programs.
Sure. I hope this answers your question, and if it doesn't, let me know. But the way we've kind of talked about the use of AI and integrating that in graduate medical education is more in terms of surgical learning. So it unlike cataract surgery training, where with cataract surgery there you can kind of think of cataract surgery as predictable steps, right? So each surgery follows a very predictable, series of steps, and you can really perfect it each step, so to speak. And some people even break it down and have like residents, do one step at a time and really concentrate on one step at a time and hone their skills. With vitreoretinal surgery, some things are amenable to that, but not all. There's a very wide variety of cases, and each case is different. You can't really say at the beginning of a case, oh, okay, this is what we're going to do, A, B, C, and D. Things can change just, even intraoperatively. So because of that, I think it's difficult for us to come up with like a well-defined rubric to assess our fellows. But I think this is where AI may help us and play a role. I always try to provide immediate feedback to my fellows during surgery. But as you were saying, we have responsibilities to our patient, and sometimes actively during surgery, it's hard to kind of keep track of movements and maneuvers to be able to kind of assess accurately how our learners are doing. But I think if we can record our cases and maybe utilize AI to kind of come up with metrics that can give our learners feedback on how they can improve certain maneuvers, that would be a more objective way of doing so, instead of just giving subjective feedback at the end of the case, which we could miss, certain things that they're doing. I think using AI to kind of break down the different steps and then giving them formalized objective feedback could be a useful tool in the future.
That's really interesting. So correct me if I'm wrong, but one way of doing this would be to maybe train an AI agent to provide almost like you might have an AI tutor, an AI surgical mentor, so to speak. So if maybe Alex Yuan has his own algorithm, or maybe it's a collection of thoughts from the faculty members at Cleveland Clinic. And so, no matter where a fellow is operating, they're obviously only going to be operating with one attending. They can actually get the pooled knowledge of all of the faculty for every single case that they do. Usually on surgical conferences, fellows are presenting maybe one out of many cases, but they could literally have that for every case, or maybe even beyond training. So if they wanted to know, oh, what would Alex say, they can actually maybe do that through an AI agent. What do you think about that?
I mean, I didn't think of the beyond training portion, but that's exactly what I'm talking about, is really kind of train the tool, and it could be a collective experience, and the AI tool can really learn from the different from the different faculty, and then assess the learner and give the learner feedback for every single case. I think that's the strength of using an AI tool.
And do you provide any guidance for your fellows, residents, even medical students, as far as how they should be using AI to make themselves better physicians, right? There's a huge amount of information that needs to be integrated. It expands on a daily basis the amount of knowledge that's out there, and it's increasingly difficult to stay up to date. And so certainly these AI agents can help synthesize that information. But do you provide some guidance to trainees on how they should be using this so that they don't lose that journey aspect of learning, but they're still able to do it in an efficient way?
No, currently, just in terms of everyday, clinical care of patients, I have not. But that's you bring up a good point, which I will probably start thinking about, and maybe first ask them how they are currently using it, if they're currently using AI. I don't know if you actively use AI. I have not in my own practice, except in cases where I'm, looking at a patient, for example, if they're on certain medications and I'm wondering, oh, has this been reported or has that been reported? That's when I will go to AI for a quick answer. But other than that, I really haven't been using AI in my practice.
Yeah, no, I think my utilization sort of mirrors that. And look, that can also be done through a PubMed search, but there may be a number of articles, and so it can make it more efficient to try to sift through that information. Of course, that all assumes that you trust that the response to your prompt is actually accurate. But we'll have to think about this. I think that this is a new world, and so increasingly we'll have to think about how AI is playing a role in education, just as AI is playing a role in educators from grade school to beyond are thinking about how their students are going to be utilizing this technology. And I do think that the more we can prepare our trainees for how to optimally use this, they're going to be a step ahead, and that's going to really set them up, hopefully, for success, beyond training.
Absolutely.
So tell us a little bit about how your surgical program is structured. You mentioned, you like to have that your fellows have some degree of autonomy, but tell us how you've structured your surgical training program.
Sure. So it is varied because I think my colleagues here at the Cleveland Clinic, we don't all train our fellows the exact same way. So they get a very diverse training experience. Speaking for myself, I train all levels of fellows. I have worked with the early fellows and senior fellows, and the training looks very differently. So I like to start them from day one. Our fellows come in, we hold a special wet lab for them just to go over the very basics and just to make sure that they're prepared for their first actual case. There's a lot of preoperative planning that some learners might not think about. So even before you step foot into the OR, like we go over, oh, what should you be reviewing? Look at the imaging, what parts of the history are important. And then we go through, everything starts with the draping. We go. Go over the draping, go over all of the, the preoperative setup, making sure the positioning's right, going over, well, how can you optimize your hand position by maybe maneuvering the head, a certain way. If there's a high no a nasal bridge, how do you deal with that? From day one, I don't think there's any better way to learning than to actually do it. At some level, it is important for our learners to also see how we do it. So I think there's value in not just, you don't gain from just doing. Sometimes it is important to kind of watch how other people do, do things. But I don't think there's I personally don't think there's replacement for actual hands-on experience. So from day one, I get them in the chair, I get them operating. Early on, I give them very directed feedback. So I don't expect them to know what to do next, right? What all the steps are. I hope they have an idea in their preoperative planning, but I think every retina case is different and things may not move the way we want them to move, and then they have to be flexible, during the case. So as the case progresses, I'll give them very specific feedback. I like using a pointer. The cyclodialysis spatula works very well, and I kind of use that to guide them on like where to go next and how to visualize things. And I try to break it down to steps, and I have them do as much as possible, get them to a point where they can't progress the case anymore. And once we reach that stage, then I might switch with them and have them watch how I do it, so that the next time they can progress further and kind of complete that portion of the case.
That's great. That's great. And what I've seen with graduates of your fellowship program is that they're outstanding surgeons. So it speaks to the quality of the surgical training that they're getting. And I think that that's, as you alluded to, a large part of the outstanding faculty that you have, and the diversity of approaches and opinions. That's really valuable for trainees to be able to go to a place where they can learn from a lot of different people. But also what I've noticed is that, and this has sort of evolved over the past 15 years, is that the graduates from your program are, they've always been leaders, but even more so now. I see that they're frequently on the podium. The trainees are more involved in case conferences, surgical conferences, publications, of course. They're taking on leadership roles beyond their training and building upon the strong clinical training foundation that you've given them. So tell us a little bit about, what's that secret sauce that you have there that's creating the environment for your trainees to thrive.
So we our success is based on their success, and they're kind of like our kids, right? I like to think of them as our kids, and we want them to do even better than us. And I hope they know this, and I owe it to just a fabulous group of colleagues who I have. They're great mentors and role models, and we really push them to do research, to be leaders in the field, to innovate, and then to spread the knowledge. We are very pro research and want to see them and advocate for them to be on the podium. Each and every one of us, will. If we see a good opportunity for them to present, we guide them and really encourage them to submit to national and international conferences, so that they succeed. I think this is a valuable part of fellow education, and I think the way we do it here at Cleveland Clinic is we give them these opportunities. As Cole, I also has several at the major conferences. We have several programs, and we encourage our trainees to participate in those programs.
I'll give a little shout out to one of them. The Cobra Rounds are
Yes.
wonderful, what you do with Stanford. A great surgical conference, great faculty discussion there.
Yes, and I think by encouraging them to participate and really making it a part of the fellowship, I think Cobra Rounds is a great example of this. It's part of the fellowship, really. And then by their participation there, it just grows and leads to other programs, and eventually to invited talks and panels at national conferences.
That's wonderful. So, of course, you can open the door, but you also have to have somebody who's going to walk through that door. And so, you have—I'm sure you have specific qualities that you're looking for. People who are applying to your program, what have you found to be the qualities that portend success for people that you're admitting into your program?
Yeah, sure. I think past experience, past success also predicts future success. So of course we look for people who already show passion in research and kind of sharing their knowledge with others. We look for people who can express that passion and, you know, on and you know, sometimes it's hard to see on paper. That's why we really we love the in-person interviews. That way we can kind of see for ourselves how excited people are for what they've done in the past. Sunil Srivastava, who's our current chair, he was the former program director at COLI. He came up with this great idea, which we didn't do this year, but I think we're going to bring back in future years. So during the, you know, COVID-19 pandemic, where we couldn't interview in person, he had this fantastic idea of having the fellow applicants make a short video to teach us something. And I think those videos kind of helps to show the personalities, how different people like to share knowledge with others. And I think that translates well, that their excitement and joy for sharing that knowledge kind of translates well to you know, future success and wanting to share the love of retina with others at national conferences and, you know, podium talks, things like that.
That is a really great and innovative idea. I really love that, and I hope that more programs will incorporate that. That's a great idea, because you're right. You know, there's everyone smart at this stage, and there's a difference between knowing the information and being able to communicate that information. That it has relevance to communication with patients, communication with colleagues, communication to the broader medical community, and so I think that that is a really interesting way to kind of differentiate a pool of candidates that all looks amazing on paper. What about for medical students and residents who are interested in going into retina? What advice would you give to them?
I think the advice I would give them is, find an area that you really love, and then find a mentor, find somebody who kind of is, does something very similar. Or if there isn't a particular area that you love right now, maybe, you know, find a person who you gravitate towards, and then ask yourself, oh, do I want to do what they do? And if the answer is yes, then, you know, really dive deep into it. I would say, to, you know, truly dive deep into something and engage in it meaningfully and in a way that shows her passion and develop in that area as a leader, and go beyond the current knowledge. Try to expand the knowledge as much as you can.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. So, let's pivot back to your career. You've talked, very eloquently about your educational philosophy, or your philosophy as an educator. But let's talk about your basic science research, because you've basically had three careers that have been going forward in parallel, which is the so-called triple threat in academic medicine. So obviously clinically very active at Metro Health, which is a county-based hospital, safety net hospital. And for those who have trained at a safety net hospital, you know that it's very busy, and there's a diversity of pathology, diversity of patient population, which is really a perfect environment to learn. But you've also been very active in basic science research, specifically regenerative therapy, cell-based therapy for regenerative retinal therapeutics. So tell us a little bit about that work, and how you were able to continue. I mean, how can you do all three things at a high level simultaneously? I think some of our listeners who are interested in pursuing this path, they may not be sure how to do that.
Yeah, so I think it all starts with, you know, commitment and willingness to kind of take spend enough time in each of these areas to cultivate your experience in each of these areas, right? So my time has shifted during different stages of my career. I knew that in order for me to r really establish a lab and continue conducting basic science research, that I really needed to dedicate a lot of time initially. Because it's easy, I think, when you graduate as a fellow to go, full board. You don't want to lose your skills, and you just want to see patients. It's very easy to do that. It's very easy to step into a role where you're seeing a lot of patients. The difficulty with that is in forming your basic science lab. I think it takes a lot of effort and time to build your basic science program, especially during training. You're probably not going to have the resources and the time to build that part of your career. I would encourage everyone during training, focus on the clinical, focus on the surgery, but in order to come back and grow the basic science side, you need to put a lot of time into it. So what I did was, when I was interviewing, I was looking for jobs that would afford me that time and kind of guarantee me protected time. So when I first started, my first goal was to get a K award, which I think is a wonderful award program
For
to.
those listeners who are unfamiliar with that program, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, absolutely. So K awards are NIH grant funding mechanisms where you identify research mentors, and then they will fund your salary and allow you to have a lot of protected time, 75% protected time in research. So the first many years that I was out, I had all this protected time to conduct research, to build the research program. And I think that's key, because without it, I don't think I would, still be conducting basic science research. So I'm, grateful for Dr. Dan Martin, our former chair, for giving me this opportunity. And from there, once you get your K award, that helps you maintain that protected research time, and then you can grow your basic science lab from there.
So protected time, as you've said, is a key component to success. Not just well, once you get the K award, being able to deliver on your goals,
But
but
even
also in
before,
the application process.
yes. I would say even before, because I mean, if you wait until you get your K, what if you don't get it your first year, right? So once you have a lot of clinical time, it's hard to give it away, right? Well, what are you going to do with your patients? You have some responsibility to your patients, and there might not be somebody else who can take on that clinical load, who just waiting to take over all of your patients, right? So it's not like you can one day go from 50% patient care down to 25% patient care. It's not that easy. So I would encourage people who seek this path to really start off trying to get a job that allows them to have this protected time. But then work really hard and as quickly as possible to get that K award. Now, you could be creative also. It's not everyone wants to or has a desire to do wet lab type research, and you can apply for Ks that allow you to kind of blend some of your research in with your clinical care. So that is also another possibility, and there is a lot more flexibility there. But for
So
those,
there are different K awards. So tell us about those different K awards.
yeah. So the KO8 in particular is the one that is geared more towards the basic scientists, where you hold a wet lab. That one, I would say, you really do need actual protected time. But there are other K mechanisms that are more clinical based, where you can conduct clinical or translational research. And part of your clinical care and can become part of that research.
So you need time, especially early on, to be able to make yourself competitive for the application process.
Mentors.
You definitely need a department chair and a leadership that's going to afford you that truly protected time.
Yes.
And in you mentioned the next thing, which is the importance of mentors. So tell us about what do you mean by that, and what roles did your mentors play in your successful K-08 application?
Yes. So, research mentors really help you navigate the environment and help you kind of focus your grant writing skills and give you advice on where to take your research. I think identifying the correct research mentors that have the time and the knowledge in your area to help not just help you hone your own research program, but also give you advice on, well, what type of help do you need? You can't personally do it all. So, maybe in the beginning, yes, you could be in the lab, and we all as basic science, basic scientists, I think we all love working at the bench, but eventually you need to give that up. You can't be in the lab doing the research yourself all the time. And so at some point you need to start looking for help and looking for students and technicians. So part of that mentorship is also in how do you manage your personnel? How do you hire? The science mentorship also includes, I think, which areas of like which study section areas might be most amenable to your area of research. Just knowledge of the overall research landscape.
So there are sort of strategies to try to set yourself up for success in the application process, and having mentors around you who have gone through that process, who have been successful through the K process and beyond, are really critical. Now, as far as the actual grant writing goes, aside from your mentors, are there offices at Cleveland Clinic that are personnel, staff members who can help optimize your grant?
Yeah, I think signing up for things like Chalk Talks and grant reviews. I think most academic programs have these available, where prior to submitting your grant, you can have other people review it. You can talk about your ideas in front of other researchers who can really provide the criticisms, the exact same criticisms that are going to come after you submit your grant, right? So the same criticisms that your grant reviewers have, other people are going to have those same criticisms. Or there might be something that isn't clear in your presentation that it's better to find this out beforehand and kind of modify your grant before submission. Or even as you're designing your experiments, it's nice to know what the strengths are, what people are excited about, and what the weaknesses are prior to even designing or thinking about the next steps in your research program.
So time, leadership support, mentorship, and then also resources, right? I mean, you have to, if depending on the type of research that you're doing, you have to make sure that the infrastructure is present in your institution to be able to achieve those projects. Is that correct?
Yes. That's we're very fortunate here at Cleveland Clinic. We have a wonderful basic science resource unit. We have lots of core facilities and expertise in many different areas that we can utilize. We have a research group that is integrated within CoLi, so our research unit is in the same building where we see patients, which makes it very convenient and makes everything really accessible and amenable for collaborations between our scientists, our basic scientists, and our clinicians.
No, this is all great advice, Alex. So any other advice for trainees who are then now pursuing an academic career and who are interested in success in this KO8 process?
Yes. So I think, one additional comment I'll make is, get to know your program officer and communicate with them. Your program officer can advocate for you, but also help you kind of learn what's important, what they're looking for in terms of the current funding cycle, and e even bef maybe before an application is due, maybe a asked to speak with the program officer. Yeah, that would be my advice.
That's wonderful. So, there's, and I want to emphasize that there are many ways, there are many paths within research, right? You've talked about basic science, there's translational research, there's primarily clinical research, and there are mechanisms to be able to succeed and to be able to get grant support for these types of research activities. And I think that the recommendations that you've given are appropriate no matter what type of research somebody's interested in pursuing professionally. Is that right?
Yes, I think it's probably good advice not just for basic science, as you mentioned, translational research. There are probably some additional unique differences and different things you would need to navigate. For example, IRBs if you're have patient-centered research. But for the most part, I think that this is all good advice for any type of research.
So let's talk about your particular project, right, which I think is very interesting. So it's a zebrafish model, and you're looking at specific proteins with the zebrafish model that may help with retinal regeneration. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so our basic hypothesis and premise is, what is retinal regeneration? It's a healing response, right? So it's how the zebrafish and other more primitive vertebrates respond to retinal injury. They do so by regenerating the retina. So there are certain cells in the retina that can de-differentiate and then re-differentiate into the various photoreceptors and different neurons that were injured and then integrate themselves back into the circuitry. Whereas in the higher vertebrates like mice, rats, humans, we don't regenerate our retinas. But instead, in response to injury, we try to heal the wound, so to speak, and sometimes we'll form a scar. So our basic idea is that this process is evolutionarily linked. The retinal regeneration that takes place in zebrafish is actually an evolutionarily more primitive response to injury than this fibrosis scar formation process that occurs in humans.
So, and is that retained, so that you can maybe turn that switch on?
Yeah, so the idea is, can we identify certain pathways that can be modified, genetically or by even like cellular transplants that can enable you to interrupt this scar response in humans, and instead of forming a scar, can you limit the scar and even kind of push the human retina into a regenerative program?
And where are you right now with this work? I mean, are you ready to start taking this into clinical trials, or where are we at? Where are we
No,
at?
so not at that level. We're making small strides, but we're important strides. One of the things that we're looking at right now is an adhesion molecule, for example, that's important in zebrafish regeneration. But this same molecule is present in humans, and we believe in humans that this molecule might be an important part of the scar response, right? So in zebrafish, if you inhibit this protein, it leads to actually slowed regeneration, which is not really what you want, right? However, we believe that by inhibiting this protein in humans, you can actually slow down scar formation, which is something you would want. So right now we're looking at this protein and seeing what the differences are in response between the zebrafish and higher vertebrates, and see how we might be able to utilize this difference to kind of improve the injury outcomes in humans.
That's wonderful. I want to pivot a little bit to talk a little bit more about how you're able to balance your professional and personal life. Now, you had children when we were in training. They're now all grown up. It's incredible to see how grown up they are now. But for people who have families, right? They're in their training process. Maybe they've decided they have a family, they're starting a family. What advice do you have for young physicians who want a happy and fruitful family life, but also want to be successful in their professional endeavors?
So I'm glad you brought this up, Pradeep, because I think this is a very important part that is very easy to neglect. I'll tell you personally, I have never made a family decision, a decision to put my family first, that I have regretted. Never. Okay. So I think we really need to all, I mean, it's very easy, for us all to, kind of put our careers first, and perhaps even neglect our families. But we shouldn't. We really should put our families first, because some of these things only happen once, right? Your kids growing up, and their first day in school. These are important events that will happen once and never again. Whereas a lot of career opportunities, they'll come again. So I believe it's important to families are important, and you really should put that first. The way I balance it is I. Even though we're all busy, I always try to give some time to my family, and schedule it in, make it a part of your routine. For example, every week I'm going to just devote, unless I'm on call, of course, but I'm just going to devote, like, say, Friday night, that's going to be family time, and that's it. Nothing else. I'm not going to do anything else.
No, that's really important, carving out that time. And as you said, there are certain things that happen only once. You don't want to forget that. You don't want to miss it. But also, your kids are going to remember if you're not there, and so it's important on both sides.
Yes, absolutely. It's really unbelievable, to me. As you've mentioned, I've had kids when I was training. My first one is graduating from college.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. That's wonderful, Alex. And your kids are wonderful. Your wife, wonderful. I'm just so happy to see how much success you've achieved thus far, and really excited to see all the great things that you're going to do going forward, including I'm sure continuing to grow the already prestigious fellowship program that you have. So congratulations so far. Looking forward to more in the coming years. And thanks so much. Thanks again for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you, Pradeep. I'm truly honored to be on the show, and it's wonderful to reconnect with you after all this time.
If you enjoyed this video, please visit us at retinarounds.com. There you can sign up for our email list. You'll get a notification every time a new video is posted. And if you have an interesting video or a tip or trick that you'd like to share, please follow the links on our website and you can upload your video there. Thanks so much for watching.